The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
A prayer for peace in a time of war. To all the good people of Ukraine, Russia, surrounding countries in the world who are peacemakers, lovers of peace, we share your anguished cries and our hearts break 1,000 times. May you who are in danger find safety today. May the children be unafraid today. May your homes and cities and countrysides be protected today. And for the today that is delayed, may you have fierce patience and faith in the goodness of people and life. To all those in power raining down the violence, division, and deceptions of your unexamined minds upon good people. Your plans and strategies are old and broken. Your words of promise are empty and self-serving. Your tools and instruments are wasted potential. Stop your running. Stop. The enemy you face is not across any border. The conflict you create will never find an end. This path has no success. May you and each of us realize we are one people, one earth, one world. We have one past, one present, and one future. May we free ourselves and each other of the afflictive states of body and mind, views and beliefs, attachments and denials, and bring forth the great virtues of our enlightened mind, heart, and humanity. May we be tireless in our efforts to realize our true nature, our true potential, and to find our fulfillment in each other's happiness and well-being.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo. Case 265, the main case. Shui Lao asked Master Matsu, "What is the exact meaning of the ancestor coming from India?" Matsu pushed him so hard that he knocked him over. Shui Lao had immediate realization. He got up and clapped his hands and said in laughter, "Marvelous, marvelous. Hundreds and thousands of samadhis. The boundless and wonderful meanings are all on the tip of a single hair. I have understood the fundamental source all at once." Then he made a bow and left. A commentary. Matsu has a way of getting right to the point of the matter. After all, Shui Lao wants to know the exact meaning of the ancestor coming from India. Clearly, this is not a matter for intellection or explanation. But be that as it may, we should ask ourselves, what are hundreds and thousands of samadhis and the boundless and wonderful meanings found on the tip of a single hair? The verse. Trampled to death by a horse, an heir has come to life. A single glimpse of reality and the whole universe comes alive. So this morning we're concluding our Bodhidharma session. And so rather than give talks on some of the koans or teachings of Bodhidharma, although I've been including some of those, I have just pulled a couple of koans that bring up this question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma, the ancestor coming from the West? And I talked the other day about how this is a question that is was asked over and over again. I could probably give a year's worth of talks on koans drawn based on a student asking that question, what is the meaning of the Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And that, as I said earlier, that because we can, seeing it over and over again, we can just sort of write it off as a stock question, a question that, you know, in a sense becomes meaningless. And that's not going to help anybody. And so to recognize that in that question are our questions, in that question are all of our own seeking, and that we have to bring that into the question. You know, the koans are often talked about as flavorless. The first koan, mu, or original face, or the sound of one hand, are good examples of that, that we could say that they defy logic. Of course, we can make a logic around anything, the logic in that way. They don't make it easy to just grab onto some kind of intellectual idea and feel like we've got something. But so then, for the practitioner, so that it doesn't become an abstraction or pointless or meaningless in an unskillful way, then the student has to merge that question with their own yearning, with their bodhicitta, in essence. And that's part of the training, that's part of the work, is how do you bring that to life within yourself and then let that fuse into the question so then it has great power. And so in the Zen tradition, we talk about the great doubt. That doubt, the koan, and that bringing that vitality, that urgency into a koan or into your practice is raising that great doubt, the great doubt of what is true. What is this self? Why? What is suffering? What is liberation? What is the exact meaning of the ancestor coming from India? So if we think in terms of words and meaning, in the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha takes that up and somebody asks, Mahamati says, what is speech? What are words? And the Buddha says, it's a combination of projections and of words that rely on the throat and larynx, the tongue and lips, teeth and gum, sides of the mouth. It arises due to attachment to the habit energy of the discrimination of our own words and of others' words. That's what speech is. And if we think of words as just having, or just being sounds, right? I mean, that's part of the miracle of language. I mean, think about it. It's crazy, right? Right? I remember watching a movie once. I don't remember anything else about the movie. And I don't think it was even a very good movie. But it was about way, way back. And a missionary or somebody was trying to convey the significance of a written language. And the person that they were trying to convey it to, who had never encountered it, couldn't understand it. And so they said to the person, tell me something. So the person said something. And they wrote it down and then took it to somebody else that wasn't there for the conversation, brought them in and read it off. And the person realized that those scribbles communicated something, and they were like, oh. The power of language and of the written word. But if we think of that, it's just sounds, right? It's sounds that have come to take on certain meaning. So if you extract the meaning out of sounds, it's just sound, right? And some of those sounds might be pleasant, and some of them might not be pleasant. It would be more akin to music, where you just hear sounds. They don't mean anything, but they can have influence. And so without the meaning, the sounds wouldn't have hooks. It's sort of like when we listen to someone talking in a language that we don't understand. We're just hearing the sounds. We don't know what they're saying. And so the sounds have no meaning to us. They don't hook us in any way. They don't have significance the way they do for somebody who understands. And so meaning comes from the definitions of those words, but it also, those definitions and the meaning is also formed by the context in which it's conveyed, the tone in which it's conveyed. To say to somebody, hey, is not the same as to say, hey. It's the same word, but the tone changes it. The context changes it. Our memories around those words, how is it that some words become weaponized? The histories that words take on, the experiences we have with certain words, right? So when your mother calls to you, Lily Ann, right? Calls you with your full name, that's not the same as when she says, Lily. And all of this is happening with the context of family and friends, and then media takes it, society. And so this aspect of our consciousness, which Buddhism, particularly the Yogacara school, has such a deep understanding of how it is not just part of our consciousness, but it's woven through. It, in a sense, consciousness allows for language, but language in a way creates consciousness. Language, we think of it as sort of describing our experiences in the landscape, but it also creates those experiences. And so then we can understand why the Buddha gave so much attention to language in terms of the 10 wholesome actions, which are akin to our 10 precepts. There are four of those, almost half, that relate directly to language. Not speaking deceptively, not speaking harshly, not speaking divisively, and not speaking meaninglessly. In other words, to not use this powerful tool, this powerful instrument that we have in a way that actually numbs the mind. In the Lakavatara Sutra, the Buddha said, it's not that things are not born, that they don't come into being, they don't appear, but they're not born by themselves. To have no self-nature, to be empty of self-nature, is in the deepest sense what we mean by unborn. That all things are empty of self-nature means that there is a constant, uninterrupted becoming, appearing, a momentary arising that changes from one state of existence to another. That is really no existence at all, except in the sense that it has appeared in this moment. And the Buddha taught, and we realize directly, that that is the totality of what we call life. In the Sharingama Sutra, the Buddha, to Ananda, in a whole, sort of at the conclusion of a whole conversation or discussion or teaching about meaning, where Ananda keeps asking him about the nature of meaning, the Buddha finally says, Ananda, you say you don't know where the meaning lies, but the meaning being free of any fixed state, where do you want it to lie? And the way in which we think that if we can understand something, know the meaning of something, then we will know it, we will understand it, we will have something. We will have met it in some way. We will, in a way, have taken ownership of it. Which is all too often why once we name and know something, it becomes unimportant to us in a certain way. We don't really pay attention to it anymore because we now know what it is. But what is the meaning of an action? What is the meaning of Zazen? What is the meaning of Sesshin this week that we just poured our hearts into? Of the way itself, the meaning of life. What does life mean? What does love mean? What is the meaning of a war? What is the meaning of a country that people will fight and kill and die for? What is the meaning of a country? Where is the country that people are fighting for? What is the meaning of freedom that people either are attacking or trying to protect? Who controls that meaning? tyrants and demagogues and authoritarians are always, first and foremost, about controlling the meaning of things. Language. Who gets to speak? What do you get to hear? And what is the meaning given to that language? And think about how we rely upon a basic agreement and understanding of the meaning of things. And that when you say something, that you mean it, and that I can rely on that. And that when that starts to be attacked, splintered, denigrated, what's left? Now, what do we have between us? How do we relate? What can we trust? When histories are rewritten, when actions are disappeared, things that happen are disappeared, when things that are told are given false meanings, when simple truths, contracts, agreements are no longer held sacred, the glue that holds us together. As practitioners, as peacemakers, as seekers of truth everywhere, that means that we have to live by certain moral precepts. We have to live by certain agreements. And we have to do that. We have to hold ourselves to that, to those moral precepts. Isn't that what integrity means? Is. And we have to hold ourselves and each other accountable so that when we wander, we can come back. We can help each other come back. And when that begins to splinter, then the very basis of what we call life, of what we call our community, of what we call a society, is really in jeopardy. And that's why it's so important, as I said during Open Sozon, that there are people always, everywhere, anywhere, who are upholders of this. Even if you're the only one. There's so many sutras that speak about upholding the Dharma, upholding not so much the Buddhist teachings, but the teachings that are in accord with the way things actually are. That to uphold those truths, those teachings, is of the utmost importance. It's a sacred responsibility. It's interesting that in the Buddhist teaching about that, where he predicted that the Dharma would basically go through a period of degeneration over hundreds and hundreds of years. And that we are pretty decidedly in the age of the last stage. And that the markers of that are kind of interesting. That the first marker is that the human lifespan will become shorter. And so through medical science, we've actually extended our lives. Maybe that seems to be true, but not everywhere, certainly not for everyone. The next one is that wrong views will become rampant. Uh-oh. And we might say not only become rampant, but become normal, become normalized, become accepted, become unchallenged. It's like when we lose the capacity, going back to meaning, to actually think about things critically, to examine them. The third marker is when negative emotions become stronger and stronger, they become more and more a part of the sort of the commons. Rather than there being sort of agreed upon checks and balances to those strong emotions, which can themselves swing too far, right? Where strong emotions are not allowed. Go to your room if you're going to be like that, right? And so when those are suppressed, that doesn't work, right? In a way, that's a way that negative emotions can become stronger. But when they become unleashed, where there's no sort of social agreement about what is okay and what is not okay in terms of how we regard each other. That human beings become mentally and physically weaker is how it reads, but I think of that as being less resilient, less stamina, less capacity to live within the sufferings of the world, of adversity, of having a human body, of dukkha. And when the world and the environment degrade, now remember, this is an ancient teaching. At a time when it would have been ordinarily unimaginable to think about how could human beings actually degrade the earth to a point where it would be in jeopardy. I was reading an op-ed recently by Jamel Bowie, I might be mispronouncing his name, I'm sorry, who was talking about, really about the critical race theory and the push against that, largely through not even understanding what it is. But again, how a very credible, very scholarly, sort of well thought out, very sort of almost scientific way of looking at things is given a whole different meaning, because that meaning is too complicated and it takes too much attention and it doesn't accord with certain agendas. And so it's given a new meaning, which is very easy to understand and has little to do with the actual theory of critical race theory. But he was talking about how this push against lots of parents and school boards across the country that are pushing against the telling of a truer history of our country, and that are really pushing for censorship. And you don't have to look very hard to see the relationship between censorship throughout history and the loss of freedom, the loss of life. But the defenders of that push for censorship say in his writings that they're simply working to protect the nation's children, and how destructive self-serving, false views are always presented. They're never presented in terms of we want to destroy, we want to inhibit, we want to constrict. It's always presented in terms of we care about you. And so to protect the nation's children from prejudice, from psychological distress, from inappropriate material, to say that there were slaves is one thing, but to talk in detail about how slaves were treated and with photos is another. So without describing what it meant to be a slave, the word slave can mean anything. It becomes anesthetized, sanitized. It doesn't really mean anything at all. Which is the point, to prevent the cause of any discomfort, he writes, in students. And so any lessons that would put the Civil War or the expansion of the U.S. to its present boundaries, World War, civil rights, would be put under careful review, right? And these are all, of course, just euphemisms for control, for constriction, for manipulation. So any teachings, any historical teachings that would cause any individual to feel discomfort or guilt or anguish or responsibility or any form of psychological distress on account of their race or sex or ethnicity or religion or color, national origin, political affiliation. There's a bill in South Carolina that's introduced known as the Freedom from Ideological Coercion and Indoctrination Act. How Orwellian is that? And so, to avoid discomfort from a Buddhist perspective, and of course, there's teaching in a way that's appropriate. So when is it appropriate to teach children, for instance, about the Holocaust or about the genocide of the indigenous people of this country, about slavery? When is it appropriate and in what ways? Now, of course, that's an intelligent conversation, recognizing that teaching them about these histories is essential and that it will evolve, that how we speak of it to a child, to a very young child, is going to be different than how we speak of it to a teenager, as their capacity to hear and understand and experience that discomfort and then begin to put that into a context so they themselves can begin to think critically, can begin to understand themselves within their environment, within their legacy, within their ancestry, so that we can then, we being that person, can then begin to take a fuller responsibility for what we have received or what we have been denied and the costs of that and to whom. To avoid that discomfort, which is really learning, is really growing up, is really meeting the world, is facing reality, to try and avoid that ensures more discomfort, ensures a limited life that will be based in ignorance, that we will never be free, that we will never be a self-knowing and other-knowing person. We will never know ourselves or each other in a certain way. We'll never be able to hold the complexity of humanity and what it demands of us, what it is we need to be learning, how it is we need to be evolving, so that we don't continue to repeat those same personal and collective cycles. In essence, so that we can work it out for ourselves. From a Buddhist perspective, to try and protect a child or any person from the necessary experiences of discomfort and adversity imprisons them, is the worst disservice. And in a really essential way, it's not trusting that person to have the capacity to do that. And that's what I have so cherished about Buddha Dharma and the nakedness, the willingness, the need, the urgency to face difficult truths, life and death, greed, anger, and delusion, pride and jealousy, hatred within ourselves and within each other. So that we can work those out. And that is the only path to compassion. That's the only way, ultimately, that we can truly be compassionate to each other. It's not that things do not have meaning, but that their meaning is not born of themselves. And so here this Shui Lao, this student, asks Master Matsu, what is the exact meaning of the Bodhidharma's coming from India? And Matsu pushes him so hard. Matsu was considered to be a very imposing teacher, very early in the Zen tradition. His name holds the meaning of horse. And so Dada Roshi's verse, trampled to death by a horse, is trampled to death by Matsu. He was also have said to have been a very large person. So when he walked in the room, you noticed him. A big guy. He also had many disciples. And so here he pushed Shui Lao over, pushed him so hard that he knocked him over. So Dada Roshi says, clearly this is not a matter for intellectual explanation. Matsu wanted to cut through all of that and get to the exact meaning, which he could not do, not possibly by explaining. But why so abrupt? What does it take to stop? There's a story of Angulimala, the man at the time of the Buddha who killed hundreds of people. and was chasing after the Buddha. And the Buddha was just walking, and as fast as Angulimala was running, he couldn't catch up with him. And finally he called out and says, "Why won't you stop?" And the Buddha turned and says, "I have stopped. You stop." What does it take to stop? We have to often, and again, sometimes be shaken into that, be startled into that. Life does that. It takes your ground away. It breaks your heart. It appears in a way that you didn't expect, that you don't want. You lose something cherished. You gain something that you can't hold. Without the ability to take refuge, we can easily just be lost and spin and spin. But Buddhism sees all of these, not only as results of karma, but as the very moment, our moment, to shake ourselves free. In those moments, you can't rely upon what you know. You can't rely upon what you've done before. There is no precedent to this. There's a very interesting teaching in the Zwi Monki, a collection of teachings by Dogen, very different in style from the Shobo Genzo. And he says, the way, in the Zen tradition, the way is attained through both body and mind. As long as we only think that Buddha Dharma is practiced with the mind, the way will never be grasped, even in 1,000 lifetimes. When we let go of our minds and cast aside our views and understandings, and I think here he's talking about the mind of thinking, of trying to intellectually figure things out through meaning. So here, understand Dogen's teaching about body as body and mind and the whole being, but very much embodied. When we let go of our minds and cast aside views and understandings, the way then will be actualized. One sage clarified the true mind when he saw peach blossoms. Another saw it when they heard the sound of tile hitting a bamboo. They attained the way through their bodies. Therefore, when we completely cast aside our thoughts and views and practice, shikantaza, we will become intimate with the way. For this way, the reason is doubtlessly attained through the body. That is why I encourage you to practice Zazen wholeheartedly, which means throughout the whole body and mind. And so that's why in Zazen it's so important that we be practicing within the whole of this body and mind. It's why the Buddha taught in the Foundations of Mindfulness that it is the mindfulness of body, of sensations, of mind and mind objects, the whole thing. And that we are coming into intimate contact and learning and gaining the ability to know free of thought, free of concept, directly through energy, the flow of energy. We don't often speak of Zazen directly in the Zen tradition in terms of energy, which, as Sean mentioned the other day, can be a tricky word because it sounds like something. But think about how the experience of energy changes in a period of Zazen when you're very dull and listless, when your mind is distracted, and you can just feel the energy just... And then in another moment, unexpectedly, you're filled. The body is radiant. It's balanced. It's stable. And the energy is moving clearly. It's like there's no hindrance. That's what's being cultivated. We call it ki. We call it samadhi. We call it spiritual power. So Matsu pushed him over. And then Shui Lao jumped up, said, "Marvelous, marvelous. Hundreds and thousands of samadhis, the boundless and wonderful meanings, are all on the tip of a single hair." Bodhidharma taught, when you try to grasp the meaning of a teaching, you shouldn't value understanding it. Don't try and figure it out. Now, there is the teaching that we gain understanding by hearing a teaching, encountering a teaching, and then reflecting on it. And then we put it into practice. And those are expounded teachings, expressed teaching, teachings through language. This teaching that Matsu is giving is direct. It's a direct pathway. There is no time for reflection. That's why what often happens when we have direct experience, whether it's just something new that is arising as a result of our practice or whether it's realization, what is the first thing that we tend to do? Figure it out. What was that? We start describing it in our mind. We start thinking about how I'm going to tell my friend about it, right? I'm going to come into Doksan and explain what happened, right? What it was. And generally what happened is the life of that living experience is like, ooh, dead. That's why we should be attentive to how we speak about the Dharma. It's why one of the reasons why there's the instruction to not talk about what goes on in Daisan or Doksan with others. It can confuse other people, first of all, because they are not you. And also because it takes that energy of something that's alive and it starts to become an object. It's a story now. What was the exact meaning of Sri Lao's being knocked over? In that moment, there's no time and place. There is no meaning. Because it's free of time and place, because it was free of meaning, there can be the uninterrupted flow of consciousness, the self-knowing consciousness, wisdom consciousness, that is not discriminating, in which there's no before and after. In that moment, we see there is only that moment, and there's no one who knows. I think of the the story of Layman Pong. He was walking with his daughter, Ling Zhao, and he tripped and fell and was sprawled out on the ground, and she ran and threw herself beside him. And he looked at her and said, "Daughter, what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm helping Papa." And he said, "Thank goodness no one was looking." He wasn't talking about being embarrassed. He wasn't concerned about whether there were any onlookers. That all things are empty of self-nature means there's a constant uninterrupted becoming. It is not something. In that very moment, we realize not only is there no constant abiding existent self, there is no need for one. Right now, there is no constant existent abiding self. You're sitting here fine. You're listening fine. Your mind is taking in the words and meaning. Our confusion about this and the meaning we assign through our confusion, via our confusion, is what we call samsara. Because we could ask, that's all very well and good. Sri Lao has this moment, marvelous, marvelous, boundless hundreds of thousands of samadhis, but the people in Ukraine are being bombed. What's the connection? All of the suffering in every place, at every time, we can know one, there's one certainty. It arises from the deluded self. There is no other way. It is created. It doesn't have to be. It is not necessary. It is not necessary in this life to destroy life. But it's easy to do that. And we have made it very easy to do that. We have poured, I don't know. How could you study it? How much of our history's mental and emotional and physical vital energies and resources and wealth and creativity into destruction? So we clearly have seem to have a need, a faith, a belief, a commitment. And the Buddha said, that will continue because that is the nature of desire. It's the nature of samsara until it stops. Until I stop. And we need help to stop. There are moments where we need to be stopped. And the difficulty is that it often seems that to stop killing, we must kill. And sometimes that helps to stop the killing, but it doesn't bring peace. Not real peace. Hundreds and thousands of samadhis. Master Dogen said, elements come together and form this body. At the time of appearing, elements appear. Skin, flesh, bones, eyes, ears, tongue, mind. At the time of disappearing, those elements disappear. We call that death. We call that each moment. When these elements appear, I do not say I appear. When the elements disappear, I do not say I disappear. The elements do not say we have appeared. Here we are. Now we're gone. Past moments, future moments do not arise in sequence. They are not in alignment. This is the meaning of what he speaks of as ocean mudra samadhi. On the tips of 100,000 hairs. All creatures abide within this state of samadhi, unmoving, unchanging, unborn, never seeking to be apart from their own body and mind. An oak tree doesn't whine and suffer because it wants to be a maple, right? A tulip does not feel insecure amidst a crowd of daffodils. Cats clearly have no interest in becoming dogs. It's like through our greed, anger, and ignorance, or our hatred, our grasping, it's like we're trying to leave the air, the water, the element, the nature. Isn't that what dukkha is? To not have what you want. How universal is that? And to cling to that wanting. To try and leave that reality, leave that place. To have something over, to not have something that you want. It's over there. And so we will invade. We will take it. That is the plan. That is the strategy that is broken. The view that it rests upon is tired, worn out. But the very same mind, the very same elements, the very same words and meaning can give rise to bodhicitta, to the beloved community, to the possibility of loving kindness, can be a call to come in, to stop. Bodhidharma said, mortals liberate Buddhas, and Buddhas liberate mortals. When a mortal becomes an awakened one, they don't change their face. That's what we mean by impartiality, non-discrimination. You don't have to change your face. It's not about becoming someone. Where do we find our peace, our satisfaction, our fulfillment? As students of the Dharma, on the path of liberation, we have to learn how to live with an ongoing disappointment. You know, I used to think, and for years and years, felt that when I read the teachings of so many masters past and present who would speak about samsara as so painful. So painful. I'm thinking, well, yeah, but I don't know. Are you making a little bit too much of this? I don't think so. But because it is a path, and every human being is in a constant state of becoming with a constant potential, who only wants to have a life. I mean, really. What does anybody want? Just have a fair shot at a life. And so there have to be ways, paths, teachings, practices that offer those pathways. But that's not enough. There have to be people, actual people, living people, who practice them. And in any living tradition worth its salt that is offering such a pathway, those things have to be present. And we need then to be committed, because it will not be easy. And your efforts will very often seem too small for your own freedom, but certainly too small for anyone else's. And that's the deception that we need to see through. That's the lie that we need to give up. To recognize that, yes, we are small beings. We are just a small, humble community of practitioners. Barely even a single hair. And we're just here for a moment. But we're here for a moment. And we are here. And so how will we use this time? When the first moment when you as a child realized, oh, this doesn't last forever, what did you do? Well, I'm guessing that you went about the business of living, because that's the job of the living. To the final breath. Then we can live and die without regret. Not because we have eradicated all of the delusion or resolved all of the suffering. But if we practice diligently, we can put an end to that suffering by realizing its delusion, its illusion, its real nature. It doesn't exist in the way we think it does. Believing it does exist in the way we think it does is the basis for every harm. And so I said this morning that all the actions we see of every tyrant or would-be tyrant is really just a display of their unexamined mind and their karma that is not being worked out, but is working out on others. And that's what we can do. But we don't have to. There is another path, a possibility. The Buddha, that's really not up for debate. We don't debate that, right? We don't take votes What do you think? Liberation possible or not? Right? We don't really do that. We don't do that. Because that question was laid to rest. You may or may not have faith in that. That's your business. You may or may not live in accord with that. That's your prerogative. But what you do has consequences. And so do it carefully. Do it wisely. A single glimpse of reality and the whole universe comes alive. All of these great masters over the centuries were dedicated to this living truth. And they were just human beings. Simple human beings. Mortal beings. And so may we aspire to this enlightened wisdom that we have so profoundly and I hope gratefully received. And bring forth that impartial compassion that is our birthright. But it's more than our birthright. Because birthright carries a sense of you can take it up or not. You can take ownership of it or not. You can put it to use or not. And I think we cannot afford that, if we ever could. We actually do have responsibility in this world. We are responsible to each other. And that's really the only path to happiness and joy, is when we not only know that, but we live out of that. And the evidence of that is in the simplest action. You know. You know.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.